Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, and welcome to Really with Tom and Dave. Tom.
Yes. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Tom. And for once, it's not a long time since I've seen you. I don't miss you at all.
I know.
I'm in LA, and we just spent the morning together.
I know. It was very, very exciting to see you.
And yet still, we've managed to isolate ourselves for this.
Well, we can't overdo it. I think, you know, we have to limit the actual physical encounters, so to speak.
Yeah. It's true.
But it was great to have you in this space. Did you mess with my chair? Something's different here. Did you?
I don't know. Was I in your chair? Was I in your chair?
Something. I feel like you've changed something here.
I may have left some residue magic of my my persona.
Yeah, that's just your aura. Yeah. Is it your aura that's still here in the room with me?
It could be. Yeah. Does everything feel a little bit damp?
Yeah, I noticed some moisture, a humidity.
It's like musty.
Humidity in the air.
Yeah, my aura tends to smell a lot like an unfinished basement.
So it look a little mildew.
Californians don't know what I'm talking about, but...
That's right. We have a basement.
You do?
We have a very East Coasty kind of basement. It's a little scary.
I've never seen it. That's odd. You keep it a secret.
Next time you're over, we'll lock you in the basement.
There are very few of them in the West Coast.
I know. If we have a rare LA tornado, we'll be fine. But every other event, I don't know, maybe an earthquake. Maybe that's where to go.
I don't know. I don't think so.
Doesn't seem like it, right? The house
but
would
a home
be on
invasion.
Top of it.
Yeah.
Home invasion, which could be an LA possibility, I guess.
Or to avoid trick-or-treaters. That's the other.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Although we never, I mean, in 10 years, we haven't gotten one trick-or-treater here. I don't know what it is. I mean, maybe they know something. I don't know. That's
your neighborhood, those kids all have all the candy they need.
There's like 16,000 kids that go down like just one block over, but they don't make it down here. It's the lazy generation.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
They're not going to go out of their way for free snack, fun-sized candy.
We got good shit.
Yeah.
We give, but you know, we've stopped now at this point. It's like, screw it. I'm not going to do any decorations. They don't want to come here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fuck them. Let them go down the block. Give them the Snickers bars. But we digress.
But today we have because we actually are about to have a really great conversation. I'm guessing. I don't want to jinx it, but I'm
guessing. No pressure on Kevin. But this is one we have been looking forward to
very much.
For a few months for sure. And let's let's get to it. Dr. Kevin Knuth is a professor of physics at the University at Albany, SUNY, and the editor-in-chief of the journal Entropy. MDPI, which I'm not sure what that means, but that sounds cool. He is a former NASA research scientist, having worked at NASA Ames Research Center in the Intelligence Systems Division, designing artificial intelligence algorithms for astrophysical data analysis. His current research interests include the foundations of physics, quantum information, autonomous robotics, the search for and characterization of extrasolar planets and unidentified aerial phenomenon, known as UAP. He has published over 100 peer-reviewed scientific publications and has been invited to give over 100 presentations in 18 countries. And we're really, really excited to have him with us today on Really.
Really.
See what I did there? Kind of accidentally, but there he is.
There he is. Hello, Kevin.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Hi,
thank
Kevin.
You. So delightful to see you again.
Yes. It's so great to see both of you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Because we had the great privilege of meeting you at the Soul Foundation Symposium, an event where your presence was totally understandable, ours less so. How we got in is still a mystery to just about everyone involved.
Yes.
Especially, I think, I'm blanking on his name. That's not going to help us.
Dr. Nolan?
Nolan, Dr. Gary Nolan. Who looked at me like a startled cocker spaniel.
Mm-mm. I think
it was that.
I'm sure he's a Kids in the Hall fan.
I don't know.
He's got to be. So Kevin, I have 100 questions for you, but maybe not 100. We won't keep you here all night, but I'm just curious what your takeaway from Saul was. Your participation in that event and you know, what do you feel, I don't know, its significance is in the kind of grand scheme of things as this topic's kind of heating up in the culture.
It was a fantastic meeting. And there were many things that were fantastic about it. First, the people that were there. I mean, all of those people many of whom have been involved in this topic for decades, you know, all in the same room together. That was great fun. And what I really appreciated was the fact that we never even had to discuss the "are they real?"
Right.
question.
Yes.
That never even came up. Yes, they were. Of course, they're real. We all know they're real, and that made it so much easier. We could get to business rather than sitting and arguing about silly things, and that I really appreciated. And it was even the non-human aspect, you know, was pretty much accepted, you know, and I thought that was interesting too. Again, we could start to ask the hard questions, which are the ones we want to really be talking about. So I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, I agree. It was that nice skipping that whole phase of debating the reality of it, and just sort of that being as a red. So we could deal with more of the serious issues.
Right. Yeah. The people there were already sufficiently knowledgeable about the topic that wasn't an issue at all. And I thought that made a big difference. That was wonderful.
For anyone listening in who maybe doesn't know what we're talking about, the Soul Foundation Symposium was set up by Peter Skafish and Dr. Gary Nolan, along with David Grush. And it's basically to try and, as they said, to professionalize the topic of UAP and UFOs. And so you're right. Yeah. Like, I mean, I was like a starstruck boy there. Like when we got there, I was just going, "Oh my God, you know, there's Hal Puthoff. There's Jacques Vallée."
I'm the same way. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was absolutely wonderful. And I think that I liked how they set it up so that the first day of talks were basically the academics talking about, starting out talking about the science and then talking about some of the bigger issues, societal issues. And then in the second day, having focused on mainly government and military officials, you know, who had some inside knowledge that they weren't all necessarily able to share with us, but being able to hear their thoughts on the topic was really invaluable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then also the number of people coming from the field of religious studies, which was interesting as well.
And that too, yeah, that was fascinating. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It was. What are we as a society, as a civilization? How are we going to grapple with this as it as it comes to the surface, as we're dealing with this, as we acknowledge that it is here, that something is here with us? Sharing our airspace and it was both fascinating and jarring for me was the way it was kind of preparing the soil of the future for this, and how will you know, how will we collectively deal with it? I did find that amazing, and but speaking of, you know, the kind of academics, that first day you gave a talk that was really so cool, because I don't know, we always hear that like this phenomenon, you know, defies physics, and yet you applied physics to some of these things that we've see, or in some of these famous cases that we've heard about, and you said, I think one quote from your speech was, you know, the unfamiliar engineering can look like anomalous physics, but I want to, you know, if you could talk a little bit, for example, there was the you were talking about, I guess, the Nimitz case, and some of the characteristics of that, of the UAP, the Tic Tac, and would you, you know, how did you frame that? What sort of work goes into figuring out what laws are being broken and or how to apply them to tell us what we're seeing, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, right. That's an interesting case, because the way I approached it is, I really, when I started studying this, I wanted to find out just how anomalous these things are. You know, we often hear that it went faster than I've ever seen anything go, and we've heard quotes like this over and over again. But, you know, I wanted to know how fast precisely, and is that reasonable or unreasonable, and what are we really dealing with? And so the Nimitz case is interesting, because so this happened in 2004 off the coast of Southern California, and off the coast of San Diego, and the Nimitz air carrier group was there. And on the USS Princeton, Senior Chief Kevin Day was providing, you know, radar support for the carrier group. And he had been for, I think overall for a period of 2 weeks, been observing objects appearing on his radar at about 80,000 feet, which is very high. I mean, it's twice as high as our jet airplanes fly, and our passenger jets fly.
Yeah.
And they would drop
just
down
to clarity. That's normal altitude for seagulls and pelicans, though.
Yeah, not at all.
Oh, okay. All right.
Dave's not a physicist. Don't, you know, right. Understand. Or a biologist.
Yeah. So these things would appear at 80,000 feet, and then they would drop down to about 28,000 feet, which is a more reasonable altitude, but they would then track south at about 100 knots, which is about 120 miles an hour, which is way too slow for something flying at that altitude, for an airplane to fly at that altitude. There's not enough air up there to keep the plane aloft at 120 miles an hour. So these things were already anomalous. And periodically they would drop from 28,000 feet down to sea level in 0.78 seconds. So that's less than a second to drop about 5 miles and down to sea level, which is again also shocking. So that was it's a nice clean example of a nice clean description of what these things were doing that allowed you to estimate speeds and accelerations. So the minimum acceleration that they would have to be able to endure to make that maneuver is you'd have to accelerate about halfway and then decelerate to come to a stop just above the sea surface. And if you did the two at the same rate, that gives you the minimum acceleration, which you can then compute is about, you know, a little over 5,000 Gs. That's 5,000 times the acceleration of gravity, which is incredibly anomalous. I mean, that
sounds like a lot.
Really hard to imagine.
Yeah, the outside maximum that our jets can pull is something like 9 Gs, isn't that?
I think that's about, yeah, that might be the largest they can pull. The wings start ripping off at about 13.5 Gs.
Yeah.
So most equipment can't handle that, much less the pilots. 5,000 Gs is really anomalous. And the maximum speed would be at the midpoint, which would be about 45,000 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. That's about the same speed as the New Horizons probe that flew to Pluto.
Yeah. So, and within the atmosphere, that should burst into flame, right?
Right. And if this is exactly, so if this is happening in the atmosphere, you'd expect a fireball. You know, the space shuttle, you know, would come in at what, 17,000 miles an hour, which is for, you know, only half the speed, and would be on fire. So this is again where these things are anomalous and they're not behaving the way you would expect them to behave.
Yeah.
Now, but there are no sonic booms either, which is strange.
Yeah. But that could easily be just described as showing unusual flight characteristics. Wouldn't that just, I mean, is there a point in doing all this calculating and breaking it down when the
accelerations and speeds could, but not having a sonic boom or a fireball is really strange. Would be hard to imagine.
So you would say that calling it unusual flight characteristics is a bit of an understatement?
It would be an understatement, yeah.
Yeah, okay. What does I just want to get that on the record.
Yeah, what does that tell us about the...
I think there's one thing that people don't generally appreciate about UFOs, and maybe you can't really appreciate it until you work some of the numbers, but these things are really anomalous. I mean, surprisingly anomalous, and to the point where it's almost hard to believe that this was actually observed.
You also broke down the amounts of energy that would be required just for that one maneuver. If you could tell us.
Yeah, that one maneuver would require the power that you would require to perform something like this. The maximum power you need is on the order of a terawatt, or a thousand gigawatts of power, which is well more than 10 times the nuclear power output of the United States. So this little 40-foot craft is producing more power than all of our nuclear power plants. That's what the data tells us, and that's what the observation suggests. So that's really, again, surprising.
Mm-hmm.
Considerably...
Yeah,
to say the least.
Again, unusual flight characteristics.
Yeah. Exactly. Very unusual.
Would that be the, you know, there was some other, you know, there was some underwater, there were some USOs, some under, you know, which I guess we call them, what are they, you know, underwater submersible objects?
Underwater.
Unidentified submersible objects. Yeah. Although now UAP covers everything.
UAP now is technically unidentified aerospace undersea phenomena or something like that.
So,
do you prefer UAP or UFO?
I prefer UFOs. Mm-hmm. We don't really know what we're all dealing with UAPs, because some UAPs could be unknown atmospheric phenomena. And some appear to be craft, and I'm interested in the craft. That's what really interests me. So I want to know about UFOs, but
because that's another trick.
I'm also interested in the ones that fly and go underwater. So
yeah, another trick of people who don't want to sort of address the phenomena is including so much garbage in the data that it obscures. Like if you just throw in 95% garbage into what you're studying, then you can just say, well, we figured everything out, but 5%.
Right.
But you're kind of stacking the deck with garbage that you know isn't
exactly
a UFO.
That 5% is critical. That's what you're really interested in.
It's the only part. Yeah.
It's the only part
that's interesting. It seems going back at least to the 50s, that 5% is persisted. Consistently.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
From the data you've gathered, and you also study extrasolar planets, so you've studied understand interstellar travel or the requirements. What does the data tell you about where they're coming from or if they're coming from outer space, or where do your conclusions lie in terms of this? I mean, what are you starting to feel like is the more likely scenario of what is with us here?
No, that's an excellent question. And that's where it gets complicated, of course. I don't think the situation is that simple. Carl Sagan once said, about the hypothesis that these were alien spacecraft, he said that he had a hard time believing that you had an alien spacecraft arriving from interstellar space every week. And he's absolutely right. That would be hard to believe. And I think that the conclusion is that they're not arriving from interstellar space every week. They live here. They're here. They have a presence here. And you can figure that out by paying attention to how long it takes them to react to certain events. So for the in Japan, when they had the tsunami and you had the problem, the disaster at the Fukushima nuclear generating system, there were UFOs the next day in the area. And so that means that it would take light information half of a day to travel out to wherever they were. They see that there's a problem, and then they have to travel back at the speed of light to get there a day later. But that means that they're within a half light day away. Light day would be the distance that light can travel one day. Mm-hmm. So the only thing within that radius is our solar system. So clearly they're in our solar system and probably on Earth. And so I think that they live here. And I think that's what makes this a more difficult problem, in that I think the realization is that we share this planet with somebody else that we're not familiar with, who's more technologically advanced than any of us. And that's a bit worrisome.
Yes. And with probably that, very familiar with us.
And probably very familiar with us. Yeah.
And perhaps I've done to work the point of contempt.
Yeah. I sometimes wonder what they think of us. Maybe we'll find out sometime. Hopefully that will go well.
So does that mean, or does that imply that we are dealing with something? Because people throw around this term interdimensional, you know, who are not physicists, who don't know what that necessarily means. You know, what does that even mean? But I take it as a non-scientist as a sort of fishbowl effect, that there's somehow they're able to coexist with us in an invisible way. Tell us how you would define interdimensional, or if you even do, or if that is something that you think we might be dealing with.
No, that's a good question. And I think that's another difficult point, in that we don't really have evidence of other dimensions. So in fact, a lot of the theoretical work that I've done really does tell you that there are three spatial dimensions and one dimension of time, and that's it. So I'm not sure how I would imagine interdimensional, that idea, right? That idea that somehow they're with us while not being with us. There are, you know, there's some ways you might imagine this, but it's not, I think calling it a dimension wouldn't be what I would call it. So,
yeah, because even if, like, string theorists, the dimensions they hypothesize they're tiny for the most part.
Yeah, they're tiny and curled up, and they're different than these three spatial dimensions. Yeah.
Yeah. So it wouldn't be the place that UAP are hiding if string theorists are correct.
Right. No, that's where string theorists hide.
And so yeah. Yes. So we'd be more like, are we more likely to find a dimension in the quantum realm that they could? I mean, is it more likely that there's
I don't see how you can have another dimension. So that makes it very difficult. It depends on how, we're still trying to understand the foundations of physics, which is an area that I'm interested in. And so we're not quite sure why there's three dimensions, right? Why are there not four or 12 or whatever. And so there are a few other ways to handle this. So one area of theoretical work that I had done was to develop a theory called influence theory, which is the idea that you can only detect things when they influence you, right? Mm-hmm. Or influence something that influences you. That's the only way you can detect things. And so we used this to, we were able to come up with this very simple model where you have particles that influence one another. And just keeping track of the influence events, you can derive some laws of physics this way. And one of the things that we realized in working on this theoretical work, which I don't really pursue that area anymore because I'm doing something that I think is a little more fruitful, but it's possible that you could have a set of particles that influences each other and another set of particles that influence each other, and then they seem like their own little universes. But if they weakly interact with each other or can change their interactions, then you could have something that seems to pop into existence and then disappear and things like this. And so so there are some ways you could conceive of a possibility of things popping into existence and disappearing from existence, which is kind of what people mean by when they talk about interdimensional.
Yeah, I think it was maybe Max Tegmark I heard talking about something like that, that the notion that the distance might be an illusion itself, that distance might just be what we perceive, like it just varying intensities of entanglement or degrees of entanglement.
Oh, right. Yeah. That a lot of this could be generated by quantum entanglement, which is not that different of an idea of what I was just discussing.
I was wondering because it sounded similar to me. I was wondering if those are, in your framework, it's more about what would be the difference, that's a question of how these objects influence each other as opposed to entanglement.
Right.
And that would create distance.
And that also creates space. Just a concept of distance. That's right. Wow. It turns out from that theoretical work, it turns out that what we perceive as space and time is basically the only logically consistent description of events that you could ever come up with. Any description you would come up with would have to follow all the mathematics of space and time. So it would look like space and time to you. But it doesn't need to be physical, which is kind of interesting because there then is no such thing as over there, right? It's just to go over there, you change how you interact with things, and now you're over there because you're interacting with things differently. And so
would that be an end run around the cosmic speed limit, essentially?
From the work we did, it looked like you still have the speed limit of the speed of light. You still have a speed limit because all that mathematics comes out of this naturally. So, but it's possible that you could move very fast without actually moving, right? So this is kind of interesting when you are looking at UAPs and wondering how they can, fly through the air at 45,000 miles an hour or faster and not make fireballs. Well, maybe they're not actually moving the way we think they're moving. And then that might not require the same energies that we're calculating, so they might not be as anomalous as we expect. They would be anomalous in a different way, right? So,
well, I guess because even within classical physics, there's the notion that the space itself can expand faster than light. In fact,
that's true.
That the universe has at least in
its past expanded faster than the speed of light. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not an alien concept. To classical physics.
That's true.
Yeah. Unless they just make
it. So you're a physicist after all.
What I'm really good at is not sounding nearly as confused as I am. that's my one gift.
We joke about that with, we call if we know what we are doing, we wouldn't call it research. So
yeah.
Well, I think
we're all trying to figure things out.
I think that, there's a certain a humble aspect to this phenomenon, which I think is necessary, right? In order to ask the right questions. And I mean, for me, maybe it's just because my brain can go there. I mean, I find it interesting that perhaps if we are sharing some sort of terrestrial, neighbor, is it just this unfamiliar engineering that could conceal them from us as opposed to some kind of more sort of theoretical, is that on the table? They just simply have a technology that masks them from our ability? Is a lot of this just a technology that we can't quite conceive of?
I think that's a good question. And that's a good question to keep on the table, because I don't know if we don't have answers to that. So, yeah. There's a lot of possibilities. And I think that we can't just rule out all these possibilities until we, you know, get data that does rule them out. So
now, as you're juggling all the possibilities in your mind and looking at the data, is there one that you go, oh, I hope that's it? Like, is there, because I know I have my preferences myself, but is there a version of reality that you're hoping it is? And maybe conversely, is there one that you're really hoping, oh, that would be boring, I don't want that to be it, or that's too scary?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if there's one that I hope for as much as I would love to be able to do what they do. The fact that you can move so fast is pretty amazing. And some of these craft are no bigger than my car. I have my new Honda parked out in the garage, and some of these craft are about that big. And those craft can apparently accelerate at, you know, thousands of Gs and can reach spacecraft speeds and maybe go to other planets. So I would love to have a spacecraft in my garage. That would be amazing. That's what I hope for.
Mm-hmm. My preferences, I want at least some of them to be extraterrestrial, just because I want to believe that somehow we can get away from here.
Yeah, that would be nice. I agree with that too. Yeah.
You know, if it turns out they are.
The fact that they live here is difficult, because it's, you know, did they evolve here like we did and we're just not aware of them yet? Or did they discover Earth a long time ago and arrive here a long time ago and they've been here throughout human history? I mean, those are two possibilities. But I think both are interesting, but I like the extraterrestrial idea better, because that means we could go somewhere too.
Yes.
And that would be pretty cool.
What, speaking of data and collecting real data and not just relying on an image that shows up on Twitter or X or some people debating, you know, is that the mission of UAPX, is to really get like the hard information that we can start to, you know, really, really conclude, yes, no, this is, tell us about that mission and what you're working on with that right now.
Yeah, that's the idea. The idea is to get our own scientific data. It's where we're using equipment that we're familiar with, that we've calibrated and tested, and we know what the failure modes are, so we know when things are going wrong. And those are the things that you worry about as a scientist. And that's what you don't get when you're just given a video from the US government or something. You don't know the conditions under which it was retrieved. You don't know the situation that people were dealing with at the time. Whereas when you're performing an experiment, you're usually in control of all of these things, or at least aware of them, right? And so that's what we're aiming to do. And then the idea is to collect our own data so that we can start to study these things. Mm-hmm. I think that – oh, sorry. Yep.
Oh, no, go on.
I was just saying that I think that the, you know, we're often stuck on the whole, we're still stuck on the whole trying to prove the real thing to people, which I think is annoying. And it makes what we do look more like a pseudoscience than a science. I think it's much better to instead to not worry about what they are, but just to characterize them. Mm-hmm. What are they capable? What are these things doing? How fast do they move? What do the spectra of light look like? You know, so what frequencies of light do they emit? Are there patterns there? Can we learn anything from that? Do they emit electric and magnetic fields? Do they emit radiation of any kind? Those are all questions that we can answer that. Mm-hmm. And once you have that, once you've characterized them, then it isn't a question of whether it's real anymore or not, or even whether it's anomalous. It's that's all obvious. And you can then move forward. And I think that's what we would like to do.
Yeah. I think that's a big part of what was so impressive about your speech at Seoul, was that it was just, it felt very well, I guess that's a good term, unhyperbolic or even unhysterical, which that it really was just going, all right, this is what's observed. If this is what's happening, what's the underlying, what are the underlying principles that as we know them, what would have to be achieved? As you said, if it's going from point A to B, at the midpoint of A and B, it must hit its peak acceleration somewhere in there. Right. But so we're applying what we know about the world to the things that are observed. And I worry sometimes that as much as I really want science to get involved in this, and it's fantastic that you're embracing it and that someone like Michio Kaku has turned around a great deal. And
he should come to Las Data with us.
I would love to, man. I would love to.
You as well, but I meant Michio Kaku too. He can collect data too.
Go ahead, Dave. I do worry because the one person like Avi Loeb, I worry that he'll apply the data, but if the data comes back as something that's impossible, that he will just assume that it's an error in the collection of that the data is wrong, or that the observation is wrong. Because he goes on the principle that can't happen, so it didn't. But what do we do when the science comes back?
The paper that he wrote with Sean Kirkpatrick on fireballs was like that. Yeah.
Yes.
And that, I think that was that he wrote early on when he just first got involved. And I hope that would turn around a little bit. If the data points to something else, you follow the data. He has a good team working with him. I'm good friends with several of them, and they're well aware of this too. So it's
Because I had that where even when he was doing the breakdown of the data over the Ukrainian sightings, where I think he was also that was dealing with fireballs, the things that should be fireballs but weren't. So he assumed that the size of the distance had to be wrong. And what do you do when? You know, what does science do when the impossible happens?
That's right. Well, yeah, and science does not handle that well, usually. One of the first techniques is to, basically deny the data. Say that the data has to be wrong. And that's a very common response.
Where do you you have sensors, you have all sorts of means of detecting or analyzing, but where do you look? How do you look? Are you taking footage from YouTube or wherever, or are you putting your system somewhere where they can detect? Like, how do you find them to analyze them?
That's a good question. Our first effort at UAPX was to go to the Catalina Channel where the Nimitz encounter had happened. UAPX was founded by Kevin Day and Gary Voorhees, who were both involved in that encounter. So that was a natural place for them to want to go back and try to collect data so that they can learn what happened there and what happened with them. And so that's where we went, and we monitored that channel for 5 days with our equipment. And that was all documented in the movie A Terror in the Sky.
Yeah, and you got some pretty interesting data.
Yeah, the last event that's discussed in that movie is the hole in the clouds with the white dots, and we still don't really know what happened there. This was basically our first mission, and so one of the warnings that I gave when we started, we were sitting on the rooftop talking amongst ourselves, and somebody goes, wow, I hope we see some UFOs. It would be really cool. And I said, yeah, that would be cool. But really what we're going to get out of this is probably we're going to learn what not to do. And what happened with that hole in the clouds, the batteries or the FLIR cameras had been unplugged by accident at about 10 p.m., I think, when the film crew left. And then and their batteries died by 3 a.m., and then that hole appeared in the clouds at 4 a.m. And the only system that was running was the UFO DAP system with a visible light camera. Caught that 13-second video or something, really short video, and that was it. That's all we have of it. So we don't have any other data other than the UFO DAP imagery and the Cosmic Watch, which is our radiation detector. So those were our only two pieces of data. And together they suggested that something interesting is going on, but we aren't really able to do much more than that. We've worked to get radar data from weather stations along the coast, and so we've analyzed some of that. And yes, apparently something weird is happening, but we can't really say much more than that. We can say we missed something interesting, but yeah. Which is unfortunate.
What is it about Catalina? There's also Tim Galladay was mentioning there's some sort of formation under the ocean off Catalina that he wants to study. What do you know anything about that?
Yeah, I do know a little bit about that. We talked about that a bit at Seoul. He was explaining that to me at Seoul. As we mentioned before, with the undersea aspects, UFOs are associated with water. And the Catalina Channel is what we call a hotspot, where there are a lot of sightings and have been a lot of sightings for decades. There's multiple places like this around the world. You have the northern coast of Puerto Rico, off the coast of Wales, and those are examples. So it's not clear, you know, some of these places are where you have very deep water, very close to shore. So maybe there's a correlation there. You know, maybe, you know, one of the hypotheses is that these guys have bases way down in the deep ocean that we can't access and haven't seen. So it's a great place to hide.
Yeah.
We know about as much about our own oceans as the oceans of Europa. There's probably this,
a good
this
way to put it.
Same amount of space unstudied, uncharted, you know, maybe charted. I mean, we can see it probably through satellites that these, you know, the structures and mountain ranges, but it's that there's 3/4 of the planet that we have no access to.
That's really true. And I always joke that it's After Uranus, it's probably the worst named planet in our solar system. It should be called water or Earth, or instead of Earth, it should be called water or ocean. Yeah. I mean, that's what it should be called. But you know, it's the fact that we live on land makes us very, you know, we think of Earth as being a landmass, but
we're very land centric.
Yeah, we're terra centric.
We're terra centric. Yeah, exactly.
Nice.
Well, and there's something interesting. The other day the formation that Tim Gallaudet wants to go down and look at got wiped from Google Maps or Google Ocean.
Really? Oh, that's interesting.
That the formation just isn't there anymore.
Well, that's strange. Yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what to think when things like that happen. I've seen things like that happen. Once on with the moon as well, with there being something on the moon that, you know, somebody alerted me to and I was looking at, and then they updated their data and then it was at an angle where you couldn't really see it well anymore. And it was, that's happened a few times, and I'm not sure whether, you know, I don't want to dive down that conspiracy theory rabbit hole, right? But
Because
there's a lot of possibilities as to what could have happened. It could be completely innocent, but
I'm
it is suspicious.
Like, I know Tom and I talk a lot about we always think, well, at least that I can ignore. At least that I can go, no, that's crazy talk. I don't need to worry about that.
Right, exactly.
And I think for me, like alien bases on the moon is one of those that I've always thought, I can ignore that, right? I don't have to. And then at a certain point I realize, but hold on, I believe that these ships are on Earth, and the moon's pretty darn close, you know. So why should I have any trouble believing?
Might be easy for them to be on too. So it would be, that's a tough one.
Yeah. So how? Yeah, I don't really have a logical argument against moon bases.
You know? Right.
I just don't want there to be, you know, because I want something I don't have to think about.
And it's funny that. A lot of scientists who don't want the UFO thing to be a thing will say, well, I can imagine aliens coming here and putting up a satellite to observe from orbit. But, you know, they're not on Earth. They'll say things like that. But then, you know, my response to that is, but we all know that observing things from orbit is not as good as being on the ground. I mean, we talk about when you're doing satellite work, you talk about ground truth all the time. So why would you travel through interstellar space only to put up a satellite? No, you go down to the surface and you hang out there. That's what you would do.
Yeah. And it's also just a bad sort of logic pattern to think that whatever we would do is what another species would do.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, yeah.
We're clearly not engaged in interstellar travel. So we're already not like them. So,
yeah. And, so, you know, and maybe by the time we're traveling across the universe, we'll have a more sophisticated way of thinking about things.
And we won't just be,
I'm bored. I'll just leave a satellite.
Right.
I also wonder about the, you know, because the motivations, the behavior of this phenomenon is so, just for lack of a better word, just weird. It's just weird.
It's weird. It's nonsensical.
Really true. And, you know, I heard someone characterize AI as, for instance, maybe ChatGPT or 3 or 4, maybe it has an IQ of, let's say, 170. You know, maybe its IQ is at that Einstein level, and let's say that Einstein trying to describe relativity to someone with an 80 IQ is going to be very hard. It's going to be very hard for them to grasp. But in the next few years, that generation of ChatGPT will be 9 or 10, and the IQ may be somewhere around 2600, which will make communication with us very difficult if, in fact, AI reaches that level. This could be utter bullshit, but it sounded disturbingly possible that we just might be having trouble communicating with what will ultimately develop. And I equate it to Avi Loeb had an interesting observation where he thought that UAP might be very interested in our baby AI. I know it's been interested in nuclear energy in the past and a lot of activity around nuclear sites, and whether or not AI could possibly be behind or the.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The kind of birth of AI could explain somehow this either renewed activity or renewed interest, or just the fact that this is really now breaking through in the culture. And do you think that's, what do you think about that?
I don't know. I'm not sure what they, you know, of course, now we're talking about hypotheticals, right? So it gets more difficult. But so you have to really take this with a grain of salt. But I'm not sure that we can really say much about what they're interested in or what they're aware of beyond what we see them doing, right? So that's very difficult. Are they really aware of our development of AI? Do they? I wouldn't know if they could know that, but maybe they can. That's hard to know. When it comes to you know some of these objects could be autonomous probes that are running on AI, And just because they're really intelligent doesn't mean they're not weird. I'm a physicist. I'm with really intelligent people all day long, and they're all weird. So
Dave's weird.
Maybe the two go hand in hand. I don't know.
Could be.
the more the IQ goes up, the weirder you get. Maybe that's a trend, and that maybe that's can explain a lot of what's going on with UAPs. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But they do show sort of paranormal effects, right? And one of the places that this seems to occur in great abundance is a place like Skinwalker Ranch. Are we correct? Because Dave and I were talking about this before. Did UAPX do work at Skinwalker?
Some of the guys from UAPX went out there for and were filmed in one episode. Yep, I didn't get to go out, but they did. And we've had Zoom meetings with Travis and Eric and them and talked about research and what experiments they might be able to do. And that's great fun.
What do you think?
That's an interesting place. And that's another interesting situation. And you're right. The paranormal effects, follow UFOs and that's hard to accept. You know, UFOs are already hard to accept, right? And then the whole extraterrestrial hypothesis is another hard thing to accept, but the weird stuff makes it even harder. And so I think we're in for this is going to be a long ride, and we're going to learn a lot of things. I think there's a lot of big discoveries here and a lot of but there's a lot of ground to cover too.
On the notion that it's going to be a long ride, I was curious as to like, where did your ride start on this? Like, how did you take an interest in the subject, and then how did you decide to take a scientific interest in the subject?
Yeah, those are two different things. That's a good question. I've always been interested in space. I was 4 years old during the moon landings, and I barely remember them. I remember my dad carrying me and walking out of my grandma's house after we watched them first walk on the moon. And he pointed at the moon. And he said, "There are people up there." That had made a big impression on me. And I was 12 when Star Wars came out. So Close Encounters was the same year. That was in December. And so I've always been interested in UFOs, but I think that my studying them really starts when I started, that whole story starts when I moved from, I grew up in Wisconsin. I moved out to Montana to go to graduate school at Montana State University in Bozeman. And so that was the fall of 1988. So it was around the second week of classes. We had just all moved out there, and there was a cattle mutilation outside of Bozeman, where two cows were mutilated and killed. It was pretty bizarre. And there were lots of calls into the sheriff's office that night about UFOs. And this was all over the news. You know, the news people were all hyperbolic about it's either aliens or Satanists, and the world's coming to an end. So this was... We were discussing this the next day in the physics department. Several of us graduate students were in the hallway. And I think we were mostly just trying to make sense of what kind of crazy place we all just moved to, you know, because we're looking at 4 years of a PhD program and thinking we're going to have to live here for 4 years. And this is what happens here. We clearly were having a heated discussion, and we bothered one of the professors down the hall who came out to find out what we were talking about. And he tried to make us feel better by saying, "Well, yeah, this happens from time to time, and they investigate it, but no one ever figures out who mutilated the cows and why." And then we all just kind of forget about it until it happens again. And I thought, well, that doesn't make me feel better. and then he drops this bomb on us. He says, "Well, you know, what's really weird is that I have friends up at Malmstrom Air Force Base, and they're having problems up there with UFOs flying over our nuclear weapon sites and shutting down our ICBM missiles." And we listened politely. And when he walked away, we all laughed because it was really hard to imagine that that could possibly be real. And we talked about this amongst ourselves then afterwards. And like, it can't be real, because if UFOs are shutting down our ICBMs, the Air Force would be on, you know, high alert, and there'd be all sorts of stuff going on. And you don't see that. So that doesn't make sense. So that kind of became a running joke that year. Anytime somebody would tell us something weird that happened, somebody would inevitably jump in and say, but what's really weird is we have UFOs shutting down our nuclear missiles, and we would all laugh. So that just kind of stuck with me. And it wasn't until around 2015, so this is what, almost, you know, 25 years later, something like this. And I'm a professor here at UAlbany teaching an astronomy course, and I was preparing for a lecture in astrobiology. And some of the students wanted me to talk about the possibility of aliens visiting Earth. And I didn't really know what to talk about except, you know, the Drake equation or the Fermi paradox. And so to be honest, I was up late just poking around on the internet. Is there anything reasonable that I can say in class? And I stumbled on the press conference that Robert Hastings had held in 2010 with Air Force veterans and contractors who had dealt with UFOs at nuclear weapon sites. And the first speaker on that conference, that press conference, was Robert Salas, who was at Malmstrom Air Force Base. And I listened to that and was just dumbfounded. It struck me, oh my God, this is actually real, because these are serious people. And you don't carry, and Robert Salas' story is from 1967. And when I heard about it in 1988, the professor said that they were having problems, present tense. So it really sank in. I thought, this is dangerous, because this appears to be real. And why isn't anyone doing about it? Because anything about it? Well, because nobody believes it's real. And I thought, that's a really big mess. And it struck me that I should pay attention to this. Just pay attention. Try to figure out what's going on, what happens, what's known. And so I started paying attention. But that was 2015. And it was only 2 years later that you had the New York Times article came out in December of 2017, outing the ATIP program, you know, studying UFOs. And that's when I thought, yeah, scientists have to be on top of this, because this can't just be military releasing videos that you have no idea where they came from or, you know, what the details are. We have to do better. And so that's when I decided scientists need to get involved. And I decided, well, I'll do it. Why not? It'll be fun. Mm-hmm.
Do you try to engage your colleagues in academia? Do you just want your work to speak for itself? Do you try to convince anyone? I mean, how do you deal with peers and this issue? And do you find that there is a growing interest? Do you find resistance?
Yeah, I find I certainly engage with my colleagues who are friends, that I'm friends with, because I'm excited about something. You know, when I learn something new or hear something interesting, I'm excited and want to share it. So,
sure. So
I have engaged some of my colleagues about this, and made them aware of some of the data that exists. So, you know, some of them are, most of my colleagues are like, all right, yeah, this is interesting. I'm not sure I buy the whole aliens on Earth business, but yeah, clearly there's something interesting here, and certainly it should be studied. I don't want to study it. You study it. That's fine. And that's basically where it gets left, which I think is a fine place. I'm allowed to operate, and nobody's hassling me, and so it works.
Well, it's not too many years ago that you openly engaging with the subject would be a career ender.
Oh, it would have been. Yeah, exactly. And
even maybe 10 years ago.
Right. And just last year, I was promoted to full professor while studying UFOs, which I treat as a big achievement.
Amazing. So that's a huge, that is a huge achievement. Well,
yes. And congratulations.
Yeah, congratulations. Exactly. So in terms of some other interests of yours, what are you learning about exoplanets? I mean, what in terms of their how close is another Earth? What are we finding? What you know, talk to us about some of that research.
Yeah, no, that's a lot of fun too, and we're learning a lot very quickly. I mean, we've discovered, I don't know what the number is now, like 5,000 plus exoplanets, planets around other stars, and I think this is an exciting era because we're now starting to learn what the universe is really like. So this is a important time in our history. And we just got a NASA grant funded to study exoplanet habitability and to develop machine learning or AI techniques to basically learn what the planetary characteristics are based on atmospheric spectra that you can record from space telescopes like James Webb. And so that's one of the projects that I'm working on.
And what are you looking for in the spectra of the planets that would be indicators?
Right. Well, what we're doing is we're basically taking atmospheric spectra from planets in our solar system and using the known characteristics of those planets, along with generating synthetic spectra using climate models. So basically, we have about 30 planetary parameters, which are each parameter describes some aspect of the planet. What's the mass of the planet? What's its radius? What is the air pressure at the surface? So what is the average temperature? These types of things. How much oxygen is present? How much nitrogen? How much carbon dioxide? So we have lots of parameters, about 30 of them. And to basically train our AI models, where we need data. So we don't know what a lot of these exoplanets are actually like. So the trick is to model a planet using a global climate modeling and then see what type of atmosphere you get and then figure out what that atmospheric spectra would look like. And so we plan to basically do about 500 models per year. So 500 planets a year. Mm-hmm. So by the end of the grant, we'll have about 2000 synthetically modeled planets that will be able to train our AI system to be able to recognize that when you see the spectrum, it's this planet, this planet and so on.
So they're molds. They're molds you can sort of put what your findings in a sense.
Right.
And then you can, okay.
Do you ever worry that some of those synthetic planets might not know they're synthetic? they might be happily thinking they're real.
Yeah, well, I don't think the models are that complex that they can achieve consciousness yet. So I don't think we're
yet. We think our simulation is pretty complex too.
Yeah, that's right.
What's the range of habitability? Because it's all relative, right? We're learning that life is much more durable than, I mean, all the time it seems like we're like, oh, there's entire ecosystems at the bottom of the ocean with no light, no, you know, and living off of volcanic vents. And
yeah,
so
that's a big problem. I mean, these are other big questions.
Fresno.
You know, what is life? And that's a big question. My favorite definition that I've heard of what is life, is it Chris Tilden? Somebody from, it was at the Santa Fe Institute, had said, life is if it dies when you step on it. And I thought that's probably the best definition I've heard.
Well, then how does that exclude viruses?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's one thing I've never quite understood is the notion that a virus isn't alive.
Right. Well, I think that's where we run into some difficulties are those border cases between chemistry and alive, right? And it's really not quite clear where that difference is.
If you have
a dead organism, something that just died, you can't biochemically tell that it's different from one that's alive. There's no difference, actually. So that's difficult. And then you wonder whether other things can be alive. I mean, could you have life on the sun? Is it possible to have life on the surface of the sun with plasmas? Could you have plasmas that could be alive? Plasmas are incredibly complicated. So what if some of those things would be alive? And their concept of habitability would be really different from ours. And so I think it's difficult learning from one example, you know, which we basically have life on Earth here that we're familiar with as our example. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to generalize in those cases.
Would your models, when you're looking at exoplanets, would they detect civilization? Or are we to assume that all of these nearby, relatively speaking, exoplanets are going to have, tube worms and viruses potentially, or, you know, but nothing, nothing super complex? Or do we just not know?
Yeah, this project isn't looking to detect civilizations. There are other projects that are aimed at analyzing data from like the James Webb Space Telescope and others to look for city lights. It would be one of them, to look for evidence of pollution, to look for satellites in orbit. Hmm. There's several efforts to try to detect some type of civilized life.
Go ahead.
You go on.
No, I'm just saying. But from the climate, but this would be looking at what a context that life could exist within. Correct?
Yeah, we would be. What we're doing is we're given a particular planet. What would the atmosphere be like? It's basically mm-hmm. what we're looking. That's the problem we're looking at. And then once you know enough examples, then given what an atmosphere looks like, you can say probably what the planet is like.
Are there any good vacation spots nearby that we should know about that have popped up on the, you know, any exoplanets that might be salvation for Dave when he gets his rocket ship, or that are nearby? Hope for humankind.
Oh, I don't know. They're all looked interesting. I would love to see all these places. Proxima Centauri, the closest star, has a planet. I don't think we know much about that one. The TRAPPIST system, which is about 40 light years from here, has three planets in the habitable zone. Mm-hmm. And the habitable zone is the region where you would be, if there was water on the surface, it would be liquid form. So it's a nice temperature, basically. So it has three interesting planets that I would like to see, because I'd like to see how different they are. How similar are they? How different are they from each other? What kind of diversity are we dealing with?
What size would they be? Are they Earth sized or would they be?
I don't remember. I think they're slight. I think they're, I think they're around Earth size. I don't think we know about many planets that are much smaller than Earth. Those are harder to detect.
I think I heard about one that was like 1.25.
Yeah, they're all pretty Earth close size. To Earth size, I think, those three.
Yeah.
Michael Masters had a good, we had an interesting talk with him about gravity, about the unlikelihood of human bipedal life forms evolving, and that the gravity on most other planets would be heavier, and therefore the likelihood, I'm not going to say this correctly, but you'd be more looking at a low to the ground kind of life form developing that would not necessarily be upright. And he was making the time traveler positing the idea of the time travelers, that we, you know, it's us visiting us, which is interesting just in terms of, is that the life you might expect on some of these other planets, or is it there's not enough data to know at this point?
I don't think there's enough data yet. We don't have, most of the planets that have been discovered are what we call hot Jupiters. They're Jupiter sized planets that are orbiting really close to the stars. So they're hot, which makes them not at all like Jupiter.
That's what my granddad used to shout. That's what my granddad would shout when he saw a beautiful lady. Hot Jupiters. Look at her.
Right.
Yeah. But
those are the kinds of planets that we know most, that we've mostly identified. I don't think there's the number of Earth-sized planets isn't as nearly as large, and we don't know much about them at this point. So I think that's difficult.
Well, let's back up just a little bit with Tom's notion there. What is your feeling about extra tempestrial model, as Michael Masters calls it?
Prefer extra temporal. Yes, the time traveler model.
Yeah.
That's a tough one too. Certainly you have to keep all these hypotheses on the table till you can rule them out. So I think that we have to consider. And there's, you know, again, I don't know how that would work physics wise. We don't really, know how to perform time travel, but we also don't know how to accelerate at 5,000 G and barrel through the atmosphere at 45,000 miles an hour without fireballs. So I'm not sure I can't logically rule that out easily.
And he sort of presents it as being something that is in keeping with or in harmony with Einsteinian physics.
You can conceive of time travel using general relativity in this, but the problem is that usually, from what I understand, you can't go back in time to a point before the first time machine was made.
Mm-hmm.
So if that really is what's going on physics wise, then that means that somebody has a time machine now, if we've got somebody in the future coming back to visit us. And I think that would make it harder to believe. However, I'm not going to assume that that's the only way to make a time machine and that general relativity is the only theory that we're going to need to understand all of this. So, mm-hmm. I think it's a possibility that we need to consider, but
least Einstein puts forward the notion that past, present, and future all coexist, that they don't occur along a linear path.
It's more complicated than that. Right.
The arrow of time is kind of just an illusion we live with, I guess, if that's correct. I'm not sure it is.
I'm not sure that's exactly right, but these things are all still debated, and I don't think it's well understood fundamentally. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot we don't know, which is important to keep in mind. And a lot of scientists don't like to admit that, but that really is the case.
You've had some conversations with some of the debunkers that get trotted out, right? Like you've mm-hmm. taken on, I think you've had to sort of on like public sort of debate with Mick West, who I'm always loath to mention.
I don't know if I've had a public debate with him. I don't know if I've met him.
Mick West, I was trying to think. Yeah,
I've addressed some of his comments. I know that, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what's your feeling about, because one thing I'm always curious about is that debunking, it seems to be, if you can find one thread that matches your theory, then you think you've defined, the entire piece of cloth. It seems to be the way debunking works.
Yeah, that's called cherry picking your data, which would be like... that would be like saying that, I don't know, I can't come up with an analogy, but jumping to some kind of conclusion about, what we're dealing with UFOs because of one observation.
I bit into an apple, there was a worm in it, therefore all apples have worms in them.
Yeah, something kind of, like that. Yeah. But that's how debunking works that way, in that they look for any weak spot. And the moment they find a weak spot, they say, well, see, I found a weak spot, so the whole thing's nonsense, and which is not at all rational.
Yeah.
Kevin, you talked about that at Seoul, and we all found this kind of refreshing and interesting, that there wasn't that we weren't debating, are they real or are they not real? And because you feel like it's obvious they're here, we're dealing with, you know, we're dealing with something. It seems that you believe the evidence points to that beyond a, you know, beyond a doubt. Do you feel that way about the idea that we have debris or ships in hiding? Do you feel that there's the same level? Do you have the same level of confidence?
That's a good question. I think it's entirely possible. And the fact that we've had so many people come out and say that this is the case, or and not all of them have come out. I've had a lot of people come up to me personally and tell me, yeah, we have this. I know about this project. And I've heard these things. So I've heard this for years from multiple people. And many of these are people I would trust. So I suspect it's entirely possible. And, you know, even today, I don't know, it was in the Daily Mail, there was an article on Frank Milburn had come out and talked about a UFO retrieval by the UK in the 1980s. And so he's now, but he talked to me about a year ago and I heard that story from him then. So, but now the story is public, right? So
no, I hadn't heard that yet.
Yeah, he felt that he was compelled to come out and talk about the UK's, what he knew about that UK incident in order to support people like Rush, and he would come out about American incidents.
Who is Frank?
Especially now that you have the Pentagon trying to put all this, you know, trying to say, oh, this is all nonsense. But I don't think it's all nonsense. You know, they need to, need to provide evidence showing that it's nonsense rather than just saying it is.
Right.
Yeah, can you tell us about Frank Milburn?
I want to see evidence either way. I'm sorry?
Can you give us a little background on Milburn?
Yeah, well, Frank Milburn, he, one of his close friends had worked for, was basically UK Special Forces. I don't know which group it was. It was called The Interval. It was the group he was in. And they were involved in UFO retrievals. And I think if I remember right, I don't know exactly what the article covers, but that this person was involved in at least three crash retrievals.
Three.
And the one he talks about in the article is one where they downed the craft and the team was sent in by helicopter to basically cordon off the area, keep people away, secure the craft, and track down any entities trying to get away. And that's what they were involved in.
Wow.
Which is a little darker than the stories that we've heard. But this is, in some ways, this is a bit of a game changer because it, you know, and I applaud Frank for coming out about this because it's a gutsy thing to talk about publicly, but he sure has thrown a wrench into the Pentagon's machine of keeping this stuff quiet.
How did you feel about that? Yeah, what was your feeling about that Arrow report?
Oh God, that whole thing. So quick finish up with Milburn. But the wrench that he threw in is this: there is this general idea that this is all an American problem, right? And this is an American fantasy, and all of this, and that's not the case at all. This is global, and now you've got another country that it's going to have to deny that this ever happened, and they may very well do too. They're part of the Five Eyes, and you know apparently they're all agreed on how to handle this, so they may do that. But it does show that there's more going on than just these handful of American stories.
Yeah, well, obviously the famous Rendlesham incident.
The Rendlesham Forest incident's another one. Exactly.
Yeah, I say famous, but famous amongst people who care about UFOs,
right,
but unheard of by everyone else.
Unheard of by everyone else, of course.
I think about George Knapp, and we had a long conversation with George about his Russia research, you know, and just volumes and volumes of data.
The Russians treated this seriously for decades. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's not known either. There's a lot that's not known, and I think that that's
Well, the Brazilians take it
seriously.
That's one reason
that it's so easy for people to just say it's nonsense, especially scientists.
Yeah, well, I mean, James Fox's movie about the Varginha encounter is pretty amazing. And also amazing that government doesn't deny UFOs exist.
That's right. That's right.
And same with, I think, Chile and Peru, even to a certain extent.
Yeah, South Americans are very open about all of this, which is really fantastic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I have an anecdote and this is a good group to share it with. I'm going to need scientific advice on this, and because I don't know what I saw yesterday. So this was yesterday. And Dave, I didn't tell you this because I forgot, but I saw you this morning. But I was with my daughter and her friend. We were in the house. It was probably about 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And I hear this roar. And I go outside and I'm looking at something that I at first think is probably a military jet, because there's a huge exhaust. There's a, huge exhaust plume. But I'm watching it and I'm saying, no, it's going too fast. And then I saw that there was a real bubble of air around it as it was sort of, it wasn't going straight up. It was going across the sky. And so then I was like, well, okay, what's if either in a sort of an experimental jet or some sort of missile or rocket? Now, what we subsequently learned, because my wife looked it up quickly after, is we're watching this thing tear across the sky in a sort of horizontal, is that it was a Tesla rocket. It was a Falcon 9, I think, if I got that correct. So it was, and that in itself was awesome, cool, great rocket flying over. However, within the plume and dancing around it, and Kevin, as a physicist, maybe you can help me out. Maybe I was seeing something very common, but there were objects, and I was looking for them, because once I sort of decided this was a rocket, I was kind of curious about what might be around it. And there were objects that were the size of stars in the sky, and they were the brightness of stars in the sky. They certainly didn't appear to be sparks, because I think I was too far away to observe sparks. I think, but they were moving in a way that didn't quite make sense. They would be in, there was three, I saw three total, and they were as bright as stars, the size of stars, but moving in a nonsensical way, sort of around the plume, but following the object and the rocket through the sky. And I kept sort of trying to point it out to my daughter, and I couldn't make heads or tails of it, of those things. I could make heads or tails of the rocket. Is that a common phenomenon? Is that something that could be explained as detritus from the rocket itself? I'm using that term correctly.
That's a good question. I don't know. I've never heard of anything like that, and but I'm not that familiar with rocket launches. So it's hard to say.
Would this have been the Falcon launch that was them testing the rocket that we would be sending to the moon?
Well, I don't know if that takes off from here. I think that takes off from Florida. This was something yesterday.
Yeah.
That would have been, I don't know, maybe a smaller rocket. I don't think it's that gigantic one, because that's the Mars. That's going to be the one that takes us to Mars, or the lucky people that get to end their lives on Mars. But I'm still in favor of, I love space research. I'm all for it. Let volunteers go to Mars. But yeah, I didn't know if there was an associated light show that would behave the way it did. It was curious as hell.
That sounds very strange. Yeah. I'm not aware of any behavior like that, but I'm not sure that I would be. So it's hard to say.
And like Dave and his UFO that he saw with Jeremy, I did not go for my phone, 'cause I was too captivated by what I was seeing, and I don't know if it would have come out anyway, but it was, it seemed, I don't know. Perhaps I saw, well, I certainly saw something that I could not identify. So we can call it unidentified, and I won't, but I won't presume to go to our terrestrial neighbors. But it was very strange. And also because Elon doesn't ever play along with this at all. He seems to just say, nope, nothing, which is a little disappointing, I find. And also I find it dubious.
Mm-hmm.
What do you find dubious about
the blanket denying of objects Elon that appear around?
If UFOs were real, I would see them. I would have seen them.
Well, I don't know.
It's a bit hubristic too. The notion that obviously if aliens were going to come to Earth, they'd come to me. You know,
that is.
I don't know why that would happen, but.
Yeah, it seems I find it strange that they haven't seen anything, because it does seem to be a lot of activity around launches and that kind of thing. So I don't know. It seems that
that's true. There are supposedly a lot of activity around missile launches, missile tests. But I don't know about other types of launches. That's a good question. That would be interesting to know. But getting data like that's hard. And so
I'm going to find out. Exactly.
I would worry though that if and when we do go to Mars, that somebody's going to be paying attention. And so what happens when you start, you just get to Mars and then people see UFOs and they know they can't be weather balloons, right? And panic sets in. So how is that going to play out? I think that could be really bad, actually.
Or at least maybe they could go, well, we could hitch a ride back if we don't like it.
Yeah, right.
Maybe that's a blessing in disguise. Yeah.
Well, that's, I mean, because obviously that's part of UFO lore as well, that there are bases on Mars, and that, of course, there's some people that believe that not only are there bases on Mars, but that we have, that America, the U.S. has bases on Mars already.
Right.
Because I always find it, I think it's hard to imagine that just to maintain the conspiracy of silence, that they would continue to have things like, try to build rockets and spend, all these millions of dollars and risk lives to just build these ridiculous rockets to go to the moon. If we could actually just pop over there in a matter of minutes.
Yeah. There's no way we'd be using rocket technology if we have reverse engineered any of these things.
Yeah. Cause that's why I would say people saying that America has even believed that we've reverse engineered the power systems and we've got weapons based on these. And I sort of point out that the United States is the only country on Earth that has used every single weapon it's ever invented.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So it's hard to believe that we wouldn't, and also that almost every secret program in terms of aeronautics has only ever been an incremental improvement on what the Wright brothers built.
Right. That's true too.
basically the stealth bombers are our best fighter planes are still following all the same rules that the Wright brothers worked out.
That's true too. Yeah.
So Kevin, as we wrap up here, and this has been great. Thank you so much for your time and everything. What space are you watching in this next coming year? Or what do you think, where do you think some, either, of your own research or other stuff that you're looking at? I mean, what, for those interested in this topic, where should we be looking or paying attention to?
Right. Let's see. I'm still working mainly on trying to collect our own data. We're trying to develop better instrumentation and that. So that's what I would like to do. And I'm also working on writing research papers, that scientific papers that kind of bridge the gap in helping. Basically making arguments as to why it's not unreasonable for somebody else to be here. And I think making those arguments is helpful, in because otherwise you've got somebody who, a scientist who has to make such a worldview change, that's huge. It's much easier if you can bridge that somehow.
And what about embracing the UFO story? In what ways has it enriched your life? And what are the greatest frustrations it's brought into your life?
Oh, those are both good questions. I think it's enriched my life by making me, forcing me to be aware of the fact that we don't know everything. I remember when I was applying to graduate school and trying to figure out what I wanted to study, I thought, well, I'd really like to study, gravity and space-time and all of this cool stuff. But I had the impression that Einstein had figured that all out. So now what is there to do? And I think a lot of students run into that problem because of the way we teach physics. We teach physics, we know this, we know this, we know this, we know this. And you're done and you get this impression that we know it all already, which is really a false impression. But I think a lot of scientists still have that impression. And it has forced me to be aware of the fact that we don't really know a lot of things. And made me more aware of the things that we're not knowledgeable about. So that's how it's really enriched my life. There's real mystery out there, which is exciting, and it's real mysteries. And to be in a situation where you can actually study a real mystery, that's a great place to be. So I like that. How's it been frustrating? Wow, it's hard to collect any data. These things are not common, and you don't always, we don't know exactly where to look or when to look to go see them, and so that's hard. It's hard dealing with other people because, people are interested but not really interested. I think that it scares them a little, and so... Some people want to know some things and then, but okay, that's enough. I don't want to talk about this anymore. It's freaking me out. And so that's a little frustrating.
Yeah. It's a little bit like they're worried you're going to infect them.
Something like that. Yeah, exactly. So that, I think that's frustrating. Dealing with other people, while working on this can be frustrating. Not always, but sometimes.
There's almost like a little rubber band effect I find with this issue. I find it with myself, where you're stretching out your brain and your ability to comprehend to a point where it wants to just snap back and be like, okay, it's too much. It's too much.
It's too much. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think.
And then of course, dealing with debunkers is annoying. They're the denialists. They're not actually trying find the truth. They're interested in proving their own hypothesis, which is pseudoscience. And so it's they're not being scientific, and that I find annoying.
And I know I must be terribly, because I know it's really, really annoying to me that I can see these glaring holes in their logic.
Yeah.
And I'm a high school dropout. And so I'm assuming that for you, it must be just truly galling to listen to these people.
It really is painful sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. To hear them talking like especially when they've suddenly been able to figure out something that has been a mystery to the military who have been trying to, things that they've been studying for years and years and years, and they have access to all the data and they can't figure it out.
And they can't figure it out. But apparently this random guy could do it. Yeah,
can break out a protractor
in making a video. Yeah.
Well, we are enormously grateful.
So grateful,
that you are tackling this mystery and finding, answers and dedicated to getting answers. And it's really, it's great, and we need you out there, and we hope you come back sometime, and we can continue the conversation.
Oh, I'd love to. I've had great. This has been great fun. It's great to talk to both of you. So yeah, I'd love that.
We really appreciate it.
Someday we should all get together for a dinner and hang out.
That would be great too. Yeah.
Professor Kevin Knuth, on really, this was awesome, and we'll see you again soon, I hope.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Kevin.